Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Compressed natural gas is a hard sell despite all the drilling.
And I guarantee you 10 out of 10 don't know what compressed natural gas is.
West Virginia native John Nash continues to inspire.
What is this?
An aerial picture of Bluefield. This is the nearby mountain. It's called East River Mountain.
Traditional music lovers will soon be able to own the 1928 Johnson City Sessions.
We basically brought this story out of obscurity because there hadn't been much research conducted.
And we take a trip to the quiet zone in West Virginia.
Last year, the big windstorm we had, of course, and we were without power for some days and without a lot of communications.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The oil and gas industries show no sign of slowing down exploration in Pennsylvania and the rest of the Marcellus Shale region. But the type of drilling done now, fracking, leaves behind millions of gallons of wastewater. It can be high in salt content, chemicals, heavy metals, and radioactive material. Scientists at Battelle, a research institute in Columbus, Ohio, are looking for places to put it all. They've started a two-year project to help companies find safe wastewater sites. The work is being funded by a $1.8 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. Neeraj Gupta is a senior researcher at Battelle. He says they're studying rock formations in four states, including Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky, and there's still a lot to learn about storing wastewater deep underground where it can soak into the rock formations and be contained. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke with Gupta about the project.
Well, Gupta says they're not looking for specific sites, but they're gathering data. They're trying to help everyone understand the geology of a good disposal well. So they're gathering this information from studies that have already been done, and then they're looking further into the ground, deeper into the ground than previous studies have gone. Here's how Gupta describes it.
We are looking more at the storage reservoirs. You know, when you look at the deep injection formations, you know, what is the right thickness? Where is the geology right? And maybe where it's not right, you know, how much pore space there might be, what is the right injection pressure, you know, because if you pressure at very high rates above the breaking point, that's not safe. So what is a safe injection operation pressure?
You know, one of the big concerns, the wastewater or the fluid would be reinjected and then would not stay where it was put and would contaminate groundwater or would leak in some way that would be environmentally dangerous.
And that's a valid concern that people should ask those questions. You know, part of what we look at, wellbore integrity and making sure that when you construct the wells and the zones that you select for injection, they're isolated from any freshwater zones.
But are there other concerns out there in terms of where you might re-inject wastewater?
In terms of the impact on the freshwater?
Yeah, on drinking water sources.
You know, in any injection operations, if you do the right site characterization, the right monitoring and operate within your well-defined parameters, you substantially reduce the risk of anything adverse going on. You know, you have to realize that deep well injection has been going on for many, many decades. And I think there are very few examples. There are examples of issues, I'm sure, but they're very, very few compared to maybe other near-surface operations. And what we try to do is to make sure and see if we fully understand the scientific issues.
It's somewhat surprising that that study hasn't already been done, but you're saying this is kind of new work.
Well, no, some of those things are already done as part of the routine operations, and as you know, that there is regulatory framework for the injection wells. What we are trying to do is pull together everything in one place and to put more scientific meat around that question.
Was it surprising to you to find out that there wasn't that much scientific meat around those questions?
No. There has been, like I said, there has been a lot done. But you know, in this part of the country, some of the rock layers that are being used are very deep. They're 8, 9, 10,000 feet deep. You know, one of the wells that I know of is 14,000 feet deep. There is very little geologic data on some of those zones. So the more we know, better we can understand where are the good locations versus not good locations.
Well, 14,000 feet deep. You don't actually, no one scales down there. Like, I'm picturing, a space station, but underground.
No, we don't go down there. That would be nice. But we have, in our group, we have done a fair amount of drilling work for various projects.
And does it look like, to you, at this point in your research, going deeper helps to avoid some of those issues with freshwater contamination or drinking water contamination concerns?
It's not that going deeper is always the best answer. Maybe the intermediate depth, a few thousand feet, 5,000-10,000 feet deep. It just depends on the geology. And that's why, when I talk about what hasn't been done is a systematic assessment of where the geology is right. And what we want to, collectively want to make sure is that, when you build the wells, they're built properly and that we know that what we're doing has a higher level of risk mitigation.
That was Neeraj Gupta of Battelle, a research institute in Columbus, Ohio, speaking with the Allegheny French Julie Grant about a project to help gas companies find safe places to put wastewater from drilling. The most recent Marcellus Shale production numbers have been record-breaking. If Pennsylvania keeps up this pace, it'll be producing enough natural gas to supply more than 10% of what the entire country uses in a year. But with this glut, there are efforts to find new markets for the gas, especially in transportation. Compressed natural gas, or CNG, can be used as an alternative fuel to power cars and trucks. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Kusick explains why it isn't catching on everywhere.
In Pennsylvania, we have more natural gas than we know what to do with. Alan Walker, who heads the state's Economic Development Agency, puts it this way.
It's an industry that responds to supply and demand. And right now we have way too much supply. And it'll balance out because people aren't going to drill wells if they can't make money at it. So it'll come into balance. It's just there was this rush that was like the gold rush. And we are producing a lot more than we can absorb.
Unlike the rush to get the gas out of the ground, there has not been a rush to convert vehicles to natural gas. Globally, close to 15 million natural gas vehicles are on the road. But in the U.S., it's a fraction of that, about 112,000 vehicles. James O'Donnell heads Alternative Fuel Solutions, a Clearfield County-based company that specializes in natural gas vehicle conversions.
It's caught on everywhere else but here. I have customers that are from outside the country, Trinidad, Vietnam, Thailand, and they come to the United States, and I win bets with them all the time because when I pick them up, I tell them, I said, hey, let's go talk to 10 people, and I guarantee you 10 out of 10 don't know what compressed natural gas is, and it blows their mind.
It might seem surprising because right now CNG is much cheaper and cleaner burning compared to conventional fuels like gasoline and diesel. But even in a place like Pennsylvania with an abundant supply of gas, the technology hasn't caught on among everyday drivers because the vehicles can be prohibitively expensive, costing thousands of dollars more than conventional cars, and the fueling infrastructure just isn't here. In fact, less than 24 public CNG stations are up and running across the entire state. However, CNG is catching on with businesses that operate large fleets of heavy-duty vehicles, like trucking companies, public transit authorities, and waste haulers.
The economics is kind of a moving target. My own view is that natural gas for heavy-duty is gaining traction as we speak.
That's Michael Gallagher, a senior advisor with the Canadian company Westport Innovations, a major supplier of natural gas vehicle engines. Despite his line of work, he doesn't see CNG becoming ubiquitous.
I don't see a future where it's very likely where you'll have complete national built-out networks for gasoline, for diesel, for electric, for natural gas, for hydrogen. But I think you'll have you have areas where you can be using each, and some will go more national than others.
One area that is using it is Bradford County. They produce more gas than anywhere else in the state and recently purchased a CNG bus and two Honda Civics for their social services department. Democratic County Commissioner Mark Smith says they used some of the revenue they received under Act 13, the state's drilling impact fee law. He says it also makes sense because they have two nearby CNG fuel stations.
And I think our job in government is to encourage cleaner fuels and put our environment first and also save money at the same time.
On the other side of the state, the Lancaster County Solid Waste Management Authority is in the midst of switching over to 14 new CNG trucks. They received a state grant from the Department of Environmental Protection to help with the cost and plan to build a fueling station at their transfer facility, which should be open by spring. It won't be open to the public, but it will be available to other waste hauling companies whose trucks come in and out all day long. Jim Warner heads the authority and says so far, none of those companies have decided to switch to CNG.
We believe here it's going to be one of those build it and they will come, because every time they deliver here, they're going to be seeing a fast fill canopy that'll have a digital price that'll be somewhere probably $2 and some odd cents less than what they just filled up the last time they filled their truck.
Warner says another benefit is the trash trucks will be quieter and won't wake people up in the morning. But not everyone's happy about that.
But the funny thing, the irony of it is, I've heard people, too, complain because when they hear that trash truck, they quickly run down to the curb and put their trash out. And now they might miss it because they weren't able to hear their trash truck because it's running on CNG.
And the state has been working to promote more CNG conversions. The DEP has given out millions through its Alternative Fuels Incentive Grant Program. And through Act 13, $20 million was set aside specifically to support conversions to natural gas vehicles. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
For more information about the environment, go to stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. We continue our series, Inspiring West Virginians, this week with a man whose life is documented in the movie A Beautiful Mind. He's been called a mathematical genius and an economic visionary. And besides Pearl Buck, he's the only other person from West Virginia who's won a Nobel Prize. Gene Snedeker traveled to Princeton, New Jersey to meet Bluefield native John Nash.
This is my high school in Bluefield. It's a class reunion.
It's your 50th high school class reunion.
Yes. I'm in the corner here.
Yeah, how wonderful.
The man in the corner is John Forbes Nash, Jr., one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century.
This is a picture of the high school building. Beaver High School. There's another high school now. This has
We're in his office on the ninth floor of Fine Hall, the math building at Princeton University, a place some people call the mathematical center of the universe.
What is this?
An aerial picture of Bluefield. This is the nearby mountain. It's called East River Mountain. On the other side is Virginia. These clouds are pouring over from Virginia. But that is really to the east. It
almost looks like the sea pouring over into Bluefield, West Virginia, doesn't it?
and
one whole bookshelf in Nash's office is lined with photos of Bluefield, West Virginia. Now 84, John Nash left the state more than 60 years ago. But clearly, it's still important to him.
The Greater Bluefield Chamber of Commerce honors Dr. John F. Nash, Jr. for his contribution in the field of mathematics.
I just was visiting.
Over his lifetime, John Nash has sought out and solved some of mathematics' most difficult problems. And he solved them in ways that amazed other mathematicians, but not without great trials to overcome. In 2001, Ron Howard made a film about Nash called A Beautiful Mind, starring Russell Crowe. It won the Oscar for Best Picture and many other awards. The film and the book on which the film is based tell the story of Nash's meteoric rise in the mathematical world, his early career teaching at MIT, his sudden descent into severe mental illness, and ultimately his recovery from that illness. But John Nash's story begins in Bluefield, West Virginia, in Mercer County.
My mother had been born there, and she had sisters. Two of the sisters lived there and had children, and those were my cousins, and I was closer to them than other people. I had only one sibling, my sister, it's a special relationship.
Martha Nash Legg remembers Bluefield as a nice place to grow up.
I loved the mountains. There was plenty of business going on. We had a wonderful neighborhood, children playing.
Tell me what John was like then.
Well, I guess today we'd call him nerdy. His friends were ones who also were bright. He liked science fiction. He was musical. Or he is musical to the extent that he can whistle Bach.
I was quite aware that I wasn't so close to other people that were related to me. I guess I'm a little like an Asperger's type.
So you found it difficult to make friends?
Well, not entirely difficult, but I didn't have very strong friendship relations generally. I wasn't just a buddy of the group.
Even as a little boy, Johnny was drawn to mathematics.
I did have a taste for numbers. In school, I liked to work with larger numbers than we were taught to use. Five digits rather than two or three.
You talk about a book that you read that really influenced you.
Men of Mathematics by E.T. Bell. He's an American. Well, the book was somehow inspiring, the way it talked about the mathematical discoveries and what these people had done.
Nash was particularly intrigued by the 17th century French mathematician Pierre de Fermat. As a 14-year-old, John succeeded in proving Fermat's theorem. After high school, John Nash went to Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. In 3 years, he earned both a bachelor's and master's degree in mathematics. One of his teachers recognized he was a mathematical genius and encouraged him to go to Princeton University for a Ph.D. At Princeton, Nash's dissertation was in a field called game theory, at the time a relatively new concept that explains human behavior. His main contribution to game theory, which later became known as the Nash equilibrium, has been used in a wide variety of fields, from economics to foreign policy to information technology, even evolutionary biology. Nash also solved a few very, very difficult problems in pure mathematics, and he did it in a way that still inspires young mathematicians, including Dayan Slabchev, Associate Professor of Mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
Nash's papers, they are very brief and have many ideas in them. Not just one idea that solves everything, but at every step there is a new idea, and yet there is the whole picture of how everything fits together. So that is the beauty of the thing. So if you speak about the beautiful mind, then it must be the mind which is able to store so many new ideas together at the same time must be in some way beautiful.
But at the height of this brilliant young mathematician's career, John Nash developed paranoid schizophrenia, a severe mental illness. For more than 25 years, he had all sorts of delusions about who he was, who other people were, and messages he was receiving. He wandered the campus of Princeton University, writing on blackboards and whistling Bach to himself. He became known as the Phantom of Fine Hall. And then, without medication, he started to get better.
The return to sanity was a gradual process, but I did gradually rejected listening to voices. I was able to put it aside after a while.
One morning in 1994, a few years after John Nash returned to what he calls rational thinking, an amazing thing happened, as John's sister, Martha Nash Legg, remembers.
I had gotten up, and I was in the bathroom getting ready to go out with my dog. And the radio was on in the bedroom there. And I heard them say something about the Nobel Prize Award in economics. And I thought they said John Nash and game theory. I had no idea game theory had anything to do with economics. That's how much I knew about it. And brought tears to my eyes thinking how much my parents would have loved to have heard that.
After years of illness and unemployment, the Nobel Prize literally changed John Nash's life. Princeton University appointed him a senior research mathematician. Other awards and honors followed. The man who was almost forgotten was invited to lecture at universities throughout the world.
And today, he continues to tackle difficult problems in mathematics and economics.
Now, most people, of course, are retired by your age, but you're still working.
True, yes, yes. It's not unusual to work to 70, maybe 75, but now I'm 84. I could go to 90.
And he just may well do that. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jean Snediger.
I'm going to the East Cairo. I'm going to the East Cairo. I'm going to the east, I'm going to the west, I'm going to the land I love best. Roll on, buddy, roll on, roll on, buddy, roll on. You wouldn't roll so slow if you knew what I know. Roll on, my buddy, roll on. You'd better quit your rowdy ways. You'd better quit your rowdy ways. You'll get killed someday. You'll be laid in your grave. Better quit your rowdy ways. Roll on, my buddy, roll on. Roll on, my buddy, roll on.
When Ralph Peer held recording sessions for Victor Records in the state line town of Bristol, Tennessee, Virginia in 1927, he discovered the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers and essentially started the country music industry. Columbia Records wanted to get in on the Appalachian field recording business, so in 1928 they sent one of their top producers to nearby Johnson City. Now, a CD box set and book featuring the Johnson City sessions is being released. Wayne Winkler from WETS has this report.
Frank Buckley Walker had signed Bessie Smith to Columbia Records and was responsible for the first commercial recordings of Cajun music, but early country music was his specialty. He recorded Charlie Poole and his North Carolina Ramblers, Gid Tanner, and Riley Puckett in New York. He did some recording in Atlanta, but Ralph Peer's successful recordings in Bristol inspired Walker and Columbia to try field recording in the same general area. So in October of 1928, Walker placed an ad in a Johnson City, Tennessee newspaper with the headline, "Can you sing or play old-time music?" That was how he set up the first of what became known as the Johnson City Sessions. 85 years later, the music Frank Walker recorded is being released in a 4-CD box set by Bear Family Records of Hamburg, Germany. Ted Olson of East Tennessee State University's Department of Appalachian Studies, who initiated and produced the Bristol Sessions, has done the same for the lesser-known Johnson City recordings. As with the Bristol set, he and British country music scholar Tony Russell have composed a lavish 136-page book detailing every aspect of the sessions, including photographs, biographies of the performers, a day-by-day session log, lyric sheets, and discographies.
Once the Bristol Sessions box set was put out in 2011 by the Bear Family Records label out of Germany, that same label took an interest, after I had a long conversation with them, in releasing this rest of the story, you know, the Johnson City Sessions. And so for the last, say, 15 months, my colleague on the project, Tony Russell, who's based in England, who's a country music scholar, we basically brought this story out of obscurity because there hadn't been much research conducted. We really had to get creative to find out who these people were and where they came from, why they came to Johnson City. How did their records sell? What were the rest of their creative lives like? Did they continue to play music after they kind of disappeared into obscurity?
Have you heard the many stories told by old and young with joys of the many deeds of daring that were done by the Johnson boys?
Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid. Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid. Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid. Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid.
Some of the performers at the Johnson City Sessions had recorded for Ralph Peer at the Bristol Sessions. The Grant brothers, Jack and Claude, had, along with Jack Pierce, been Jimmie Rodgers' backing band. But Pierce separated them and recorded the band as the Tenever Ramblers. Frank Walker recorded Jack and Claude Grant, Pierce and Claude Slagle as the Grant brothers, but other acts didn't have nearly as much recording experience. One such group was the Motesville String Ticklers from West Virginia.
There were 8 musicians in the band, and they all came down, according to the stories that the family tell, in the back of 2 cars, with the instruments placed into pillowcases because they could not afford actual instrument cases. They made 2 recordings here, are their only recordings that we have of this band. The one known as West Virginia Hills is considered the definitive recording of the West Virginia state song. It's a much prized recording that far too few people have ever heard.
Oh, the West Virginia hills, how unchanged they seem to stand, with their summits pointed skyward to the great almighty's land. Many changes I can see, which my heart with sadness filled, but no changes can be noticed in those West Virginia hills. Oh, the hills, beautiful hills, how I love the West Virginia hills. Your land I roam, still I think of happy home and the friends among the West Virginia hills.
When Frank Walker returned to Johnson City in October of 1929, he recorded some of the most memorable songs of the Johnson City sessions, including this one from an obscure group from North Carolina called the Bentley Boys, Down on Penny's Farm.
First of all, people probably have heard it before, perhaps in the context of the Harry Smith Anthology of American Folk Music, which is a legendary album that was released in the 50s that's credited with launching the urban folk revival of the 50s and 60s.
Come, you ladies and gentlemen, listen to the song. Sang it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. May make you mad, but I mean no harm. It's just about to run his own Penny's farm. It's a hard times in the country out on Penny's farm. You move out on Penny's farm, plant a little crop of bagger and a little crop of corn. Come around and see you're gonna flit and plot till you get yourself a mortgage on everything you got. It's a hard times in the country out on Penny's farm.
This song has inspired a lot of musicians over the years. Bob Dylan, for example, dedicated not one song, but 2 songs to his love for this particular song.
Come here, ladies and gentlemen, and listen to my song. Sing it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. Just a little glimpse of a star out of town about an East Coast city that you all know well. It's hard times from the country living down in New York town. Oh, New York.
The second of 2 Bob Dylan songs inspired by the Bentley Boys Down on Penny's Farm, recorded in Johnson City, Tennessee in 1929.
One of the most famous people who came to Johnson City for the Johnson City sessions was Clarence Ashley. Clarence Ashley is a legendary musician who, in fact, is credited with having introduced the world to Doc Watson. Mm-hmm. Because Clarence Ashley recommended that Ralph Rinsler, who is affiliated with the Smithsonian, to come down to make a record of Doc Watson in the early 60s. And then, of course, Doc took off from there. But Clarence was famous in his own right with this marvelous voice, very high-pitched and mournful, and this unique frailing banjo style.
Oh, the cuckoo is a pretty bird. She wobbles as she flies, she never hollers cuckoo till the 4th day July. I've played cards in Dingbong, I've played cards in Spain. I'll bet you $10 I beat you next game.
Olson and co-writer Tony Russell were nominated for a Grammy Award for the book that accompanied the Bristol Sessions box set. The book accompanying the Johnson City box set is even more extensive and represents a tougher job tracking down information.
We had to work through secondary sources, namely family members who remembered people. And to find these people wasn't easy, but the way we did it was we put ads and articles in local papers all over the Appalachian area in eastern Kentucky, western North Carolina, and of course East Tennessee. And lo and behold, people started calling us and writing us from out of the blue, saying, we saw this article in the paper, and we'd like to tell you about our ancestors who played at the John City Sessions. So Tony Russell and I just started to gather the stories over the last 15 months based on this very rudimentary technique of getting the word out. And we were able to get some wonderful stories.
Next weekend, a series of events in Johnson City will celebrate the release of the box set, including an album release party at Johnson City's famed music venue, The Down Home, on Saturday night, followed by a recording of the public radio program Mountain Stage on Sunday night. Relatives of the performers at the original sessions will be honored at these events. But unfortunately for some of the performers at the original sessions, many of the records didn't sell well. Some were never even released, because the final day of the 1929 sessions coincided with the first day of the stock market crash. That's one reason the Johnson City sessions were not as well known as those that took place up the road in Bristol. But Ted Olson contends that the Johnson City sessions have their own special place in music history.
It may not have the kind of overarching impact of the Bristol sessions box set. I mean, after all, people have been calling the Bristol Sessions the Big Bang of country music for some years now. There's no comparable statement you can make about the Johnson City Sessions in the respect that they didn't necessarily create a genre almost, you know, single-handedly. We don't make any such claims for the Johnson City Sessions. The Johnson City Sessions, in my opinion, are very important because they show Appalachian music in the widest possible variety at the cusp of the Great Depression. And I think that's important because really the music that sold during the Great Depression tended to be more commercial music. The music on the Johnson City Sessions is kind of that last bastion of traditional music finding voice in a mass media environment. Three of the strongest records on the Anthology of American Folk Music were recorded in Johnson City in 1928 and 1929. It's a quieter story. It's a story that gets, has gotten a lot less attention than the Bristol Sessions. But it's a story whose time has come.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Wayne Winkler in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Going back, Johnson City. I'll go back and stay someday.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. It's unusually quiet around Green Bank, West Virginia these days. The federal government shutdown means the National Radio Astronomy Observatory had to furlough most of its employees and cease most of its research. Even when the observatory is open, Green Bank is a pretty quiet place where many forms of electronic communication are banned. NPR's Elise Hugh recently visited to learn more about why this area is a quiet zone.
There are no physical signs you've entered the National Radio Quiet Zone, but the silence of your cell phone is a pretty clear signal.
How many bars do you have?
Zero. Searching.
NPR photographer John Poole and I noticed the silence near the Virginia-West Virginia state line. Almost every radio station disappears, except for Allegheny Mountain Radio, which broadcasts at a low enough frequency to avoid being banned.
Welcome back to Traffic Jam. I am Dr. Diller. I'm your DJ this afternoon.
DJ Caleb Diller hosts a weekly show. He grew up here in Pocahontas County, West Virginia.
We didn't realize that the rest of the world was like getting connected and staying connected constantly, you know, via phones and computers and all that. And so, you know, we were kind of, you know, back in time a little bit. We hadn't progressed to that.
They still haven't. With state and federal laws keeping out cell phone towers and Wi-Fi signals here, residents of Green Bank, a no-stoplight town, check the internet over landline connections or at the local library. That's where we found Arnie Stewart, who moved here after retirement.
Those people that have lived here all their lives have grown up without cell phone, so they don't miss it.
For fun?
Hello, Arnie. I'd say I'm probably 40 miles.
Some of them chit-chat.
N-A-K-U-K. Okay.
Over ham radios. Pat Schaffner says his ham radio hobby has actually helped in emergencies.
Last year, the big windstorm we had, of course, and we were without power for
some days and without a lot of communications, all the phone lines were down. So we had different spots around the county that we could talk from one end of the county to the other and, you know, maybe relay about a store being open or somewhere having ice.
The reason for the low-tech life here is actually because of a sophisticated radio telescope at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Unlike the tube-shaped optical telescopes you might be thinking of, a radio telescope looks like a giant satellite dish. The Green Bank Telescope is as tall as the Washington Monument and large enough to fit 2 acres of land in it. Karen O'Neill oversees the site.
It's a huge collecting area, and it's what allows us to see these incredibly small energies that we're trying to study. The types of energies we look at are less than the energy of a single snowflake falling on the Earth.
Energy from Wi-Fi signals can confuse or interfere with the telescope's readings, and it can trip up antennas at the government's Sugar Grove Research Facility, which is also in the zone, so no interference is allowed.
It is still the quietest place within North America.
We still have communications. It's just older dial-up telephones. We still have phone booths.
That's observatory engineer Chuck Nide. Each week, he drives a 20-mile radius around the Green Bank Telescope, policing for possible interference.
Let's say someone has a Wi-Fi service set up near the observatory that's causing this interference. We can ask them to shut it off, and most of the times they do.
But keeping the noise down around here is getting harder these days. Karen O'Neill.
So if you think back to 1956 when the site was first built, there were issues with radio noise, but most of those issues came about through cars and spark plugs and power lines. And now we're living in a society where everything is wireless.
And constant connectivity has become a consumer and cultural demand. George Murphy is IT director at the Snowshoe Ski Resort. It happens to sit right inside the zone. So Murphy has to get creative to get customers cell service without running afoul of the astronomers.
We have to find a way to communicate that doesn't interfere with them.
This summer, Murphy got a system of shoebox-sized antennas installed in the resort's retail village. It brought cell phone service to a pocket of Snowshoe for the first time ever.
This was huge. This was huge. From the day I started here, I was working on this project with several different companies.
So change is in the mountain air here in West Virginia. But for most of this area, life remains slower paced. Instant messaging and texting is still something Chuck Nide, the interference cop, sees on TV or when he travels out of town.
It's nice to be able to just pull something out of your pocket and send a message to someone and get a response within 30 seconds or so. But I don't know that it's that necessary. At least it's not around here.
Around here, the people seem content to stay disconnected. Elise Hugh, NPR News.
West Virginia filmmakers were highlighted last weekend during the West Virginia Filmmakers Festival in Sutton. The honor for Best Short Film went to Miracle Boy, which was shot in Greenbrier County. Producer Jason Brown says he'll always be a West Virginia filmmaker, despite his Georgia address. West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly joined Brown for a special viewing at Concord University.
Matt, come out wherever you are!
Young boys are running through a cornfield as they yell. They're looking for Miracle Boy, another young boy who is kneeling to hide from the would-be bullies. Dialogue is limited, filled instead with sounds of West Virginia mountain country. Concord student Cassandra Malchinoff says it brought her a new appreciation for film.
It definitely made me feel at home while I was watching it.
The storyline follows a young boy who is injured in a farming accident and then bullied by other boys. But more than that, producer Jason Brown says it's about doing the right thing.
The story was about a young boy taking accountability for his actions. I think at the end of the day, what we were trying to get across is the humanity in that one young boy and seeing his mistake and making up for it.
Bullying has made national headlines in recent years after pushing some children to commit suicide, and West Virginia is not immune. Although it wasn't Brown's intention, Miracle Boy has been used by counselors and anti-bullying advocates across the country. Malchinoff plans to show it to other students at Concord.
I'm so passionate about anti-bullying because I see it here on Concord's campus.
Brown is a native West Virginian and Concord graduate. He currently teaches communication courses at Valdosta State University in Georgia, but stays true to his roots by encouraging West Virginians to see past and beyond the mountainous borders.
We often don't fulfill our own sort of possibility because here in southern West Virginia, a lot of times we get stuck sort of in the mountains and we don't see what's really possible. And you have to believe in what's there. You have to see it and believe it and then believe in yourself. And then the other half of that really, I believe, is create your own opportunities.
States across the country offer different levels and types of tax incentives to filmmakers. While states like North Carolina are debating whether to continue giving tax breaks and how big they should be, West Virginia's program is relatively underused. Brown hopes more people will realize the opportunity for filmmaking in the mountains of West Virginia.
The two best things we have going for us with Miracle Boy, it's pretty and the sound is amazing. But I'll tell you what, it was real easy. All we had to do was point the camera because so much of Greenbrier County is beautiful. And you just had to point the camera in the right direction and turn the microphone on.
Still, Brown suspects the biggest challenge or barrier for filmmakers in the state is the same as it is for him, infrastructure.
So much of the industry anymore, you don't have to be in Hollywood. But if we don't have the internet, we don't have the air flights, there is the investment here, I will stay. I will come running back. We have a lot of people that can do things from here and touch the world. They all want to come back and make movies, but what they need is investors. They need support. And gosh, you know, just in general, we need West Virginians to support West Virginia.
The festival run of Miracle Boy is expected to end after two more screenings. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Athens.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. This year's State Filmmaker of the Year is West Virginia Public Broadcasting's own John Nakashima. He talked to West Virginia Public Radio's Ben Aduccio about his many years in film and what it means to win the award.
For more than 30 years, John Nakashima has made documentaries at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. But he's also done more. He co-edited the cult classic film Chillers and worked on animated films like The Griffin and the Minor Canon, which is based on a book of short stories penned by Frank Stockton. Nakashima is now being honored by his filmmaking colleagues with the state's award for Filmmaker of the Year.
The best reward is to know that people are watching your better work. That's really the best award. It's really great to be recognized. I'm in a line of people who have been recognized by that award. It's just nice. You know, it's just a nice thing. Because, I mean, I hate to say this, but it's like publish or perish. It's that kind of thing. So, you know, what I did last year was great, and that's my past, but now I have to do something else.
Nakashima is not a native West Virginian. He grew up in Iowa, one of five children, the son of a doctor and a nurse. He moved to West Virginia in 1975 because he wanted to work at a small PBS station. His brother was a professor at WVU and told John about the job. When looking at his entire body of work, Nakashima says his favorite project was the 1995 documentary Mountaineer. This film examined what it meant to be a West Virginian and looked at the stereotypes of people here.
My father and mother was mountaineers, and they was raised, you know, just like I was. They was raised to do for themselves. Mountaineers are always free. It means not only a freedom of expression, but even a physical freedom, a sense of freedom. I love the mountains. I wouldn't be satisfied anywhere else. And I love the earth. I love the ground. Now, a lot of people love it because it's worth money, but I don't never consider the money or what it'll grow or nothing like that. I just love it. I love the contours of it and love to walk over it.
I didn't see anything else like it. You know, I didn't see kind of an encyclopedic look at mountain culture. And I also saw the opportunity to, you know, there's all these hillbilly stereotypes in Hollywood. I was asking everybody I knew, what's the most appalling hillbilly stereotype thing you've seen on TV or in a movie? Trying to find that, and we collected hundreds. We even got the little Bugs Bunny characters doing a scene from Deliverance, which was pretty amazing. You know, I always call Mountaineer my opus to West Virginia. It was kind of a gift. It was a gift to me to be able to do it, and it was a gift to the people of West Virginia. It was kind of a love letter to West Virginia.
In recent years, Nakashima's worked on documentaries about Appalachian music like Blind Alfred Reed and Cliff Top.
You know, you look, listening for the chord changes, listening for the rhythm, and then once you kind of get into the groove, then you stop thinking. Then you stop thinking. When you close your eyes and you just kind of, some people at these late night jams at Cliff Top and elsewhere, you know, they consider it to be kind of like a mantra. You know, you just kind of get this large group of people getting this rolling, repetitive tune and rhythm. You know, you want to get to where you're not thinking about it.
One of the things I like about documentaries is you get to find the best people that exist, if they're within driving distance, in the topic. And you get to have this privileged conversation with these people, and you get to share that with people who, you know, you ordinarily wouldn't be able to sit at the kitchen table with Irene McKinney or Denise Giardina or John Williams, you know, all the great people I interviewed, Kate Long, and have them give their best arguments about why West Virginia is so fantastic, and give like really in-depth analysis that, you know, you could only present in a documentary.
And when asked about some of his favorite experiences using a camera, he recalls one moment in which he caught a glimpse of nature.
One of my favorite things that I did over the years is the simplest thing I did. And it was Steve Lawson and Betsy Lawson. And I went to their house at sunrise. And they have an incredible bird feeder. And I just recorded their voices. And we just looked at what birds were flying up to their feeder. And that was like just a 6-minute thing, and it was just beautiful in its simplicity.
Chip Hitchcock worked with Nakashima on two recent documentaries, West Virginia: Road to Statehood and Frank Kern's American Correspondent. Hitchcock says Nakashima shows in all of his pieces a strong sense of compassion.
I think what separates him from other really talented filmmakers is he also has a huge heart, and he uses that heart all the time in all of his shows. To get at the human aspects of each one of his documentaries and to celebrate that. And he does an incredible job of that, and he builds emotion really well using his heart.
Nakashima is working on a new hour-long documentary about West Virginia's children who live in poverty. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our new website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.